I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I am back with another Saturday stream, and in the first hour, my guest is Gregory Hood, the other Greg. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
It is great to have you back. We had a conversation a couple days ago that's going to be coming out on Amren, and I thought, well, maybe he'll return the favor and come and talk about The Northman with me, because at the time we recorded, I hadn't seen the movie, and I went and saw it on Thursday, and I was very impressed. I thought it was a tremendous film, and I wanted to talk about it with you because I read your review, which is up at American Renaissance. It's more of an essay than a review, and I want to discuss it because I think it's a really rich film. It's directed by Robert Eggers, who directed at least two other films that I've seen. One is The Witch, which I thought was an excellent film. The other is The Lighthouse, which I really found distasteful, to be quite frank. This, I think, is a superb film. I think it's a masterful film, actually. And I'm very, very impressed with how accurate it is, how it has the feel and the look and the ethos of the Vikings, for good and ill. It's all there. So since you've committed yourself to writing on this, what are some of your thoughts?
Well, besides the obvious ones that were in the essay, one of the things that the director got a lot of criticism for is that it's an entirely white cast, which, of course, would make sense considering time and place in which the story is. But we're at the point now where that in and of itself is seen as offensive. And I think what's also seen as offensive in this film is all the slavery is taking place against the Slavs. It's almost like we have to remember that they were called that for a reason. Because, and I think you said this when you were talking in what seems like a different lifetime ago about stuff white people like, the premise behind all of this stuff is that white people can never be on the losing side of history. That white people have just never suffered. No bad ending for white people is possible, as you put it way back when.
Yeah, that was actually the words of Christian Lander.
Yeah, it's Christian Lander himself said that, right?
Yeah.
And you quote him. And here you're seeing white people go from royalty to fighting for their lives to slavery to back to royalty, all with this mythic background where the gods and the divine may or may not truly be present. The director kind of gives us, the audience, an out on that if we want it. But clearly to the characters involved, these are all things that they take for granted. And I think it's a challenge in a number of ways too, because Hamlet, obviously, it's probably the most famous play ever written, performed, probably the most penetrating in terms of looking at the human psyche. But this is the source material for it. And you can't do colorblind casting with Amleth. You can't do colorblind casting with this thing about the Vikings. I mean, they try to do it in some of these shows, and it always comes off as just inherently hilarious. It doesn't particularly bother me when I see a multicultural casting of Hamlet, you know, black people in the court of Denmark, whenever they're setting it. And the reason we don't care is because we say, okay, this is a universal thing. But it's not a universal thing. It's actually rooted in a deeper tradition, and this is that source material that Shakespeare was drawing on. And it's important for us to look at these things too, because the main thing they say about whites now is that we don't have a culture, that we are nothing, as Dominique Vanier put it in his book, that we're constantly told that we're nothing. And even the things that we have, we got via other people. The only reason we had the Renaissance is because the Arabs saved all the learning from the classical world, that type of thing.
Right. The saving the classical world basically means all the stuff from the classical world that they didn't destroy.
Right. And also
ended up with.
And one of the big things, just as an aside, one of the big disputes right now is with the Byzantine Empire, we always had a link to the classical world. There was never a point where the West was cut off from this kind of thing. But
no,
that messes with the narrative that we would all be savages in caves if it weren't for the Arabs. Well, here we have something where you say, okay, here's European man at arguably his most savage, arguably not civilized, at least according to some people. You have royalty literally becoming a beast in a mythic framework in this, where he actually gives up, he actually asks the gods to allow him to shed his mortal form. And in some ways he does, at least for the battle. So here's us at, according to a high civilization point of view, quote unquote, our worst. And yet it's so compelling that it's better than just about anything else you could get from any other faith tradition. And I think that the biggest thing, especially as somebody who's deeply interested in paganism, the European New Right, and everything like that, I've always been a big critic of Reconstructionism, which is this idea that, you know, we're going to put on tunics and walk around like it's still the 800s or something like that. Like, no, we live in America in this century. If these things are to have any meaning, they have to be relevant to the problems we're facing now. But to me, a film like this shows that these things are eternally relevant. This idea that you do have a fate, that you don't just get to create who you are. There are certain things in your bloodline and in your character and your destiny that are just set out before you. And it's just a question of whether you're going to rise to it or not. And that's the exact inverse of what our society teaches today, where basically a person finds themselves or creates a personality for themselves, and they can always change it, right? They can always change their gender. They can always change their politics. They can always change their name or how they want to present themselves. And in contrast, we have something where you are a link in this chain, and all of these things that make you who you are, you didn't choose. And they're actually more important because you didn't choose them. You can spend your whole life trying to run away from these things, but your destiny is set. And I think that's what I literally believe, but leaving that aside, I think that idea is something that European peoples need to start thinking about, the idea of fate, the idea of destiny, because right now it feels like rootlessness is the biggest problem that we have, where instead of a culture or instead of the idea of having any kind of a mission or purpose, you essentially create a personality for yourself and then select certain brands over the course of the next 30, 40 years, and then that's your life. And I think a lot of people are finding that not very meaningful. And here, albeit in a savage form, a form that you can't exactly practice in that way anymore, but it shows you, no, like there actually is an alternative and there is a different way of looking at the world.
Yeah, I thought one of the more beautiful images in the film that communicates this is the tree of ancestors. Amleth has this vision of his line going back into the past and his place in it, and then going on into the future later. None of this is anything he chose, right? But you don't choose your identity. Your identity is handed to you. Now, you can do certain things with it, but you can't choose it. You can't erase it. You can't start over new. You're not a tabula rasa. You're not society's tabula rasa. And you're certainly not your own tabula rasa. That wouldn't make any sense at all. The idea that you can create yourself is literally a trait attributed to the Christian God who's self-caused. And it's a very strange idea when you start talking about a human being his own cause, being a prime mover, et cetera. So yeah, I do think this is a wonderful film at communicating a sense of being thrown into a world, having an identity that's given to you, that's not chosen, having obligations that are imposed upon you that aren't chosen. And yet, there are also choices that people make. And I thought one of the most important things in the movie and the thing that made it most dramatically satisfying is Amleth. He's told by this seer, this prophetess that he has a vision of in the land of the Rus, that he will face a choice between kindness to kin and vengeance on his enemies. And he faces that choice when he decides that he's going to flee with Olga, leave Iceland. And yet, before he can do that, he has a vision that she is carrying twins, and she confirms that she is pregnant. But she wasn't going to tell him yet for a while, you know, wanted to be sure and all. Well, at that point, he says that actually, he's not forced to choose between the two. He's not forced to choose between the two because he says that as long as his uncle lives, his children will not be safe. And therefore, it's not a choice between kindness to kin and vengeance on his enemies. they're one and the same thing. To secure the future of his own bloodline, he has to go back and kill his uncle. And so he does that. And I thought that was great drama. It was a great dramatic choice. He's given a destiny. He's given certain choices. And then he decides, wait a second here. I have to go back. And he's going back not to basically satisfy his own personal honor at that point, not to carry out a blood feud that's placed upon him by his father, not to do anything like that. He's going back to secure the future of his own family, which I thought was very dramatically satisfying. And it shows that there's real character growth in this. And that's one thing that I wasn't getting from some of the comments on this by friends of mine. Amleth starts out as a savage. Olga describes him as a savage. His behavior is savage. He's part of a band of slavers, right, and berserkers, and they behave in a terrible way. And yet he grows beyond that in some way. And he grows beyond just carrying out the will of his father to making his own choices. And I think that's genuine moral growth, genuine character growth.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that maybe is a little questionable, because what does he say right before he leaps off the boat? I was a fool to think I could escape my fate. It's not so much that he chooses, it's that he says he's known nothing but hate. He'd be glad to be rid of it. He leaves. Now, again, he has already taken vengeance somewhat at this point by killing his heir. And he's killed the older son at this point. He hasn't killed the younger son. He hasn't killed his mother. He hasn't killed the uncle. But then when he sees the vision of the future, it's almost a reminder, the same way the seer was after early in the film, that, hey, you've strayed from the true path. You have to go back and fulfill this thing. I mean, to me, it was actually sort of an indication that if you try to veer away from your fate, you're going to get forced back onto it, whether you like it or not. And the vision that he gets at the end, and this is one of the things that we just kind of have to take on faith that this is really happening. It suggests that his descendant, you know, a maiden king, as I think the one seer calls her, it, from the appearance, it looks like it's going to be Olga of Kiev, who, of course, was one of the biggest reasons that the Rus became Christian, something that she forced down with pretty incredible tactics when that polity was first being formed. And so I think he grows up and he certainly changes and learns that there are things worth valuing other than blood and death. But every time he tries to break away from his fate, something forces him back. And so to me, it's almost that you can grow as a character, but the end of the destination is still the same way. And you spoke about the band that he joins. There's a book called, I believe, Odin and the Indo-European Mannerbund. And it's kind of an academic text, and it talks about these kind of wolf cult initiatory dances that young men in a tribe would get involved in. And they would live somewhat outside the realm of the community. These were basically the guys who were the raiders. These were the guys who'd be the first over the walls, but they were also your scouts and basically the people you could afford to have die. So it was pretty interesting to me that when he pops up as part of this warrior band, I mean, he's a 40-something year old man. And even in the movie, it'd be hard pressed to think of him as less than 25 or 30. And yet he's kind of taking part in this thing, which was basically for the guys who were just starting off. If you take it that he's becoming part of a berserker gang, then he's essentially committed himself to living entirely outside society forever. But it is pretty abrupt how he gets returned to his mission right away once he sees the seer. And even when he's in that warrior band, he does hold himself apart. When he sees, you see it when all of his friends are celebrating afterward and drinking, he leaves and goes out, and that's when he gets that vision. When they're setting the hut on fire and they're enslaving everyone, he doesn't express opposition to it. Why would he? This is the culture that he's been raised in. This is the mission they're trying to accomplish. But he doesn't participate in it. And of course, later he also has that line where he says, "I don't kill women." And you think to yourself, okay, well, why does he care one way or the other? Clearly, he's approaching this. He has a certain code of honor as a warrior that goes beyond just rapine and burning. And so I think that, and he also keeps the token that his father gave him at the beginning, which interestingly enough was taken off another prince. So really what he's wearing is just another plot point in some other prince's revenge story. And if you read the sagas, which a lot of this was taken from, like the grabbing the spear in the air and throwing it back, Njal's saga, a lot of it really are these centuries-long blood feuds that sound very petty if you look at it from our point of view, and we say, well, it's a good thing we don't live this way anymore. But an honor-based society is essentially the only way any frontier society can operate for any length of time. And this idea of you have responsibility to your blood, not just to protect it, but also to avenge it. Because if you don't do that and you're seen as weak, you will be displaced. We can say that maybe that's not exactly the kind of society we want to return to, but what we have now, what some have called the victimhood basis of modern morality, where the way you gain social status is not by accomplishing anything, nor is it by claiming certain inherent rights and going to the government and saying they should be respected. The way you get power in our society is by becoming a victim and then essentially staging a performance for third-party actors like the media, like the government, like NGOs, to focus attention on you and then take vengeance on your behalf. And as savage as some people would say this film is, it's a lot more direct and it's a lot more honorable than the system that exists now. I mean, to me, I think it's a lot more human if somebody's, you do wrong to somebody and their kid comes after you someday. That makes more sense and is more defensible in some ways than a system where a court, based on an accusation by somebody that may or may not be true, can take all your property away and doom your kids to poverty forever, and there's just nothing you can do about it. Because right. This is the social order that you're in now. I think that the progression from an honor-based morality, which, and that's what still exists in large parts of the world, and what still exists certainly among working class people and everything else, is I've often said that the division between the middle class and the working class, it has nothing to do with money, because there are plenty of working class people who, if you're a construction foreman, you're making way more money than some grad student is. But the difference is, if you're working class and you get into a fight, somebody wins and somebody loses. If you're drinking at a middle-class bar and there's a fight, everybody gets arrested, because that idea of you actually having to stand up for yourself is just completely foreign.
Right.
There's always an outside authority that you appeal to. There's always cameras that have to get whipped out. There's always evidence that has to be gathered. You can only do that if you're at a certain level of civilization. And I think there is a question that we need to ask. Is there a point where men become too civilized? Where when you see something like this, even as we say, okay, maybe this isn't exactly what we want, but isn't this at some level a corrective to what we have now? Because the system we have now, it's not only not working, but it's making everybody who participates in it a contemptible person without honor.
Yeah, well, but let's chew this over a bit. Somebody cuts you off in traffic and you want to kill them or something? I mean, we see this in inner cities, right?
I would say the culture of disrespecting and all this kind of stuff. But there's an intermediate stage between an honor-based morality and a victim-based morality. And that was basically what we called a rights-based or a dignity-based morality, where essentially you have certain rights because you are a person and you have a certain dignity. And if these things are violated, we trust the state to intervene on your behalf, because we know that if we don't do that, you just get these endless blood feuds that don't go anywhere and nothing can ever get done. But the problem is now we've already lost. This is all premised upon the idea of an objective rule of law, the idea of rules that apply to everybody, regardless of their social standing, regardless of their race, regardless of any of their other social characteristics. It depends upon having a reasonably efficient and not corrupt government. And all of these things are starting to fade. And so one of the things that we're starting to see is sort of a return of the most savage parts of an honor-based system, as you point out, in our inner cities, where the even solving a murder is almost unheard of in some cities. And yet, at the same time, in the upper class, you have this culture of, I'm not even going to call it effeminacy, because it's not that, it's not an affectation. It's more of just this absolute refusal to take any responsibility or any accountability for anything.
Right.
The idea that I am serving a role, and if something happens, it may bounce back on me, even if it's not entirely fair, because I am the person in authority, I have power, therefore I have certain obligations. That's entirely foreign. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, I think what really brought it home was when you had the collapse in Afghanistan, how nobody, it's not just that nobody resigned, it's that nobody was even asked to resign. Yeah. It just immediately went to spin, and that was it.
Yeah, it's shameless.
Right. And that's one of the big things, is that if you have an honor-based society, the counter to honor is shame. And if you do not live honorably, as he's kind of initiated into this pseudo-Edenic cult, which is for some reason in a cave and underground, which seems a little wrong, but okay, we'll go with it. When he's initiated into this thing, he's told that living honorably means that he needs to swear to avenge his father no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, that's not that different than what he was told in what the essentially the same character was told in Hamlet. I mean, he is told to swear to this ghost that he will avenge his father's death. So even in more civilized ages, the idea of taking direct responsibility, direct vengeance, was not completely out of the question. The difference is that Amleth does not have the same sort of hang-ups about conscience, about whether he catches his father at prayer. That whole subplot, the reason Hamlet didn't take revenge in Shakespeare's play, of course, that's not even a consideration. The female character here, we don't have Ophelia committing suicide. Instead, we've got an earth witch helping him in his plans. Yeah. I would say a very much more powerful female character than you see in Hamlet. And I think that the idea of this man lost his father, his kingdom, and really his beliefs about the society in which he lived, because he comes to learn that his mother was a slave and that he was essentially, or could be, the child of rape. Although we don't quite know. I mean, let's keep in mind, she tries to seduce him too. She strikes me as the kind of character who will say whatever works in that moment to try to get out of whatever sort of trouble she's put herself in. Mm-hmm. So everything she says, we have to take with a grain of salt. But the idea that you have a certain obligation that you can't cast off without being a shameful person, that there are certain things that if you fail to do, you won't be able to live with yourself. And furthermore, that when he does these things, it's not just he's avenging his own petty honor, and it's not just because he wants to go to Valhalla. He understands that he's setting up a dynasty. And so he does kind of have a sacred mission. And this idea of a sacred bloodline is very powerful. I mean, what are the last words the War Raven says to his brother before he's killed? Bearing a stolen ring does not make a half-breed a king. Soaked in my royal blood will sliver off your arm like a serpent. And sure enough, that's what happens. And when the true heir takes the pretender out of the picture and creates a new generation, what happens? That house is going to return to being royalty, only this time in Kiev and under a woman and presumably Christian, at least based on the symbolism that they use there. So, I mean, I think that these ideas of rootedness, the idea of having a personal stake in vengeance and doing what needs to be done, and the idea of these brutal measures were done And it's not that we should try to imitate them, but we should understand that this is the world our ancestors came from. And they did all these things so that we could live in a slightly better way. And therefore, we have an obligation to keep our society on the upward path, to keep it progressing. Because right now, it seems like it's declining into something where we get the worst parts of savagery and decadence at once.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't like, well, I mean, it's a real thing, but it's also sort of perennial theme in fiction of a soldier or a policeman who guns down a evil person, and then he feels bad about it and has doubts, moral qualms and doubts about it. Not having killed anybody, I can't really say what I would feel, but it just strikes me as morally confused and soft for people who, you know, they've just gunned down somebody trying to kill them or some maniac or something like that. And then they're feeling moral confusion about it. I don't get that. One thing I liked about Amleth is that he did not have any moral confusion really about killing his enemies. And he went about it in a pretty brutal and cunning way. It's kind of amazing, actually. I thought the violence in the movie was extremely brutal, not overly graphic, but it was quite brutal. And there was no moral ambiguity about it. There was no soul searching about it that I thought.
Well, that's,
and I don't like
that's
that.
Just the biggest thing. I mean, if you think of, let's go back to Hamlet for a second. His to be or not to be speech is the reason we remember it, the reason it sticks with us, is it because to some extent his moral concerns paralyze his action. And directly it stops him from having his revenge. When he comes upon his uncle, the false king, praying, the only reason he doesn't kill him then and there is because the uncle would go straight to heaven. Little does he know that the uncle is trying to feel guilt, is trying to feel some sort of forgiveness, but isn't getting it. So even if he did strike then, he probably would have gotten his revenge, but he can't see into somebody else's head. For Amleth, none of these problems crop up. And it's not even a question of good or evil. It's a question of noble or ignoble. Again, his father, when he realizes he's about to be killed, he doesn't call him evil. He calls what's happening to him a misdeed. It's you're doing something that is not in alignment with the divine order, and you're bringing ruin down on everything, and you'll be punished for doing it, even if you think you're being clever. The flip side to this is that if you believe that you have a sacred right, not just to vengeance, but also to this kingdom that was stolen from you, whatever you do along that path, it's not that it's good. It's that certain forces are going to assist you. And The film plays with us a little bit saying, oh, you know, the mound dweller, the fight there, what did that really happen or not? But after a while, it gets pretty hard to argue that Odin is directly taking a hand in what's going on here. Mm-hmm. There's a sword that people can't pull out unless it's in the dark. We've got ravens, you know, pecking him free to make sure he can stop from being tied up. He's got all sorts of things that are, there are no other explanation other than divine intervention. And this is how sagas work. Now, what's interesting is that the source material on this, the story of Amleth, and also a lot of the other sagas that they touched on, are just as violent, if anything, more violent. And there's always a lot of tricks and petty revenge, and the idea of taking vengeance on someone by being clever is seen as somehow praiseworthy. Like there's nothing ignoble about posing as a slave and then revealing yourself and, you know, taking his head. But these things also just don't happen. These things all happen where somebody does something wrong according to the social structure of that time. And that sends civilization basically plummeting off a cliff because everybody's committed to all these blood feuds. And we have to have sagas about whether a young person really even has free will or freedom of decision if the purpose of your life is just to take vengeance on behalf of your grandfather or somebody you've never met.
Yeah, yeah. This is why I do think that there was some growth as a character here, because when he goes back to complete the blood feud, he's owning it now. This is not something that he's doing for his father. It's also something that he's doing for himself and for his descendants. And I think that that creates a different moral meaning to it. He's not just being pushed along by the past. He's also embracing this because he has a stake in it now, a vital personal stake in this, in completing this, in killing his uncle, and basically killing his uncle and his uncle's bloodline, so they can't continue this feud on in another generation.
Yeah, and you also see, I think one of the least persuasive parts of it to me was when he finds out that his mother essentially was the one who started this whole process, leaving aside the question about a mother having such hatred for her own son. But it's clear that his father, the king, was well respected, had a certain amount of notoriety, and made, maybe she had started off as a slave, but she was made a queen. I mean, she was treated as a queen by the court. She wasn't disgraced or anything like that. And by any indication, after the king is killed, like, okay, now you're the wife of a king in exile, a sheep farmer, that the rest of the world, like traveling war bands, are laughing about, saying you killed your brother for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And when he confronts his mother tells him all these devastating things about his father and how his father was worthless and how she wasn't actually screaming. She was actually laughing. And I listened really hard the second time I saw it to see if she was. And like, yes, she is. She is laughing. You can catch it. But we also have to keep in mind that she says all this stuff and then immediately says, well, why don't you kill him? And then I'll be your queen then. So this to me was one of the sort of the weaknesses of the whole thing, because Hamlet's anger at his mother for marrying too quickly. I mean, scholar after scholar has had a field day with the sexual connotations and the various readings of that. But here, it's because the mother is so forthright with this stuff that she almost ceases to become an interesting character. It's just like, oh, wait, this lady's just crazy.
Well, she's a monster.
Yeah, and she's also, you could understand the lady. It's basically like Lady Macbeth, except Lady Macbeth is plotting to actually be reduced in social station. Like, it's a kind of ambition that doesn't even make any sense. And that was sort of the only thing in the film where everything felt a little forced. Like, oh, of course, this is how he has to kill his mother. This is how he has to kill the young boy whom he had said, we should remember, I will bring the boy with us if we must. Remember, he says that to Olaf. So he is not willing to kill his half brother. He's not willing to kill his enemy's bloodline because he's not willing to kill a child. And he does it essentially by accident. Mm-hmm. And I thought that to some extent that was kind of forced in there, but then that's also the nature of sagas, that you get forced into these situations, and regardless of what you do, like, this is going to be the outcome.
Right, right. Folks, if you would like to chip in with your questions, thoughts about this film, if you've seen it, if you have some objections to it, things you like about it, whatever, please do share them. You can share them in the DLive chat. You can share them in the Odyssey chat, or you can go to entropystream.live/countercurrents, and you can leave a question or comment as well as a donation. And we very much appreciate this. We have very few means of receiving donations by means of credit card. We've been doing such good work over the years that we've been blacklisted by the global credit card industry, and therefore we have to use Entropy. And we can also use Cash App if you'd like to send donations through Cash App, or you can send a tip through Odyssey. Those are our three ways of doing that, and we very much appreciate it. We have a fundraising goal that we have to meet each year to keep Countercurrents alive and to keep it growing. and we very much appreciate it. So if you want to join in the conversation, please do. I very much appreciate any donations you can send. You can also toss in your DLive tokens, your diamonds, lemons, ninja genies, etc. And that's very helpful as well. I'm not seeing any questions yet, but we've got almost half an hour.
Go ahead. One thing I would point out with this too is you could sort of interpret this film as this was the kind of paganism that was needed to make Christendom possible, because obviously the protagonist, his death is sort of the end of an era, in that his father had ruled in this place. He recalls his grandfather ruling in this place. They're all being part of this Odinic cult, father to son being initiated. And but when he sires this new royal lineage, they're not going to be initiated into that cult. They're essentially going off to start something entirely new among an entirely different group of people. And it's built on savagery and the willingness to defend your rights. Certainly Olga of Kiev did that in the real world. Just because she was a woman didn't mean, and a Christian, didn't mean that she wasn't willing to shed a lot of blood as a means of state policy. But you definitely get a sense at the end of this that this is sort of the twilight of the gods. And he goes to the gates of hell in this place in Iceland. He's welcomed into Valhalla, at least he thinks he is. And the question then is there anybody who's going to be riding in after him? Mm-hmm. You already get some mentions of Christianity, although they don't really understand it. They just are used as suspects because they see some body parts nailed up and they think, oh, well, isn't this what the Christians do? They worship a nailed up corpse. They don't really understand what they're dealing with quite yet. There was one guy I saw who's rowing who had a Thor's hammer. That actually was a response to Christians of the time wearing crosses. The mm-hmm. crosses came first, the Thor's hammers came later. So that also shows that there's some sort of indication of religious competition there. And of course, you have a dispute between different gods in the two main characters. The protagonist and the antagonist worship different gods. Mm-hmm. And from different pantheons, not the different pantheons, but different groups, technically, but the Aesir and the Vanir. And I think that the film is not trying to be neo-pagan. It's not trying to say this is the way things should be. It's simply saying this is the way things were. And I think there's value in understanding this is where you come from. Now, in terms of paganism today, I do think that this idea of resacralizing the world is something that a lot of people in our movement, be they Christian or non-Christian, are really looking towards. This idea that there has to be something more than just consumer transactions. There has to be something more than simply living in this country that seems to be built on the ruin of everything that came before it. And when you look at how quickly social norms have been transformed in just the last two decades, I can't even imagine what an older person must be feeling. I mean, it's a complete reversal of everything that they were told was good and true. And so I don't think it's an accident that you see more interest in paganism and occult stuff and these types of things. But what matters is not so much what people seize on, but what kind of values they take from it. I think that at the end of the day, I have more in common with the type of person who likes the medieval heritage of the Catholic Church than I do with some lefty neo-pagan who's upset because of Charlemagne or something like that. I think that here we're seeing a glimpse of the pagan practices, the cult of honor, and really the cult of heroic action that Christianity was then able to take and shape and turn into the ethic of chivalry. Now, whether that was actually Christian or not, or whether that was just warmed over paganism, or whether that was just a cynical way people in power had of using, getting people to fight for them, that's up to you guys. I won't step in on that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that's odd about the chronology is that it takes place at the very end of the 9th century. And the Christianization of the Rus didn't really take place until almost 100 years later. So it was odd that the people that they captured were supposedly Christians. That seems a little bit anachronistic to me.
Well, there'd be a few of them floating around at that point.
Would there be a whole communities of them?
No, but you didn't really see whole communities of them. I mean, even among the slaves that were captured, they were just a minority. I get the sense that the Christians that they found were essentially just random people who happened to get mixed into one community or the other. Mm-hmm. I mean, Christianity in Northern Europe, with the exception of Iceland itself, was really pushed by the top down because mm-hmm. it was a centralizing force that the monarchies could use. In Iceland, it was also sort of pushed from the top down, but they had a big meeting, and depending on who you believe, they created a compromise where they basically said Christianity will be our religion, but if you do pagan stuff secretly, we're not going to look too hard for evidence. Mm-hmm. And there was a point where there was sort of a, just as the Jesuits arose in response to the Protestant Reformation, there was definitely a sort of counter movement of paganism in Northern Europe as Christianity continued to make headway. But I mean, as we see in this movie, paganism isn't really a thing. I mean, it's not one faith. It's not one body. It's not one system of beliefs. Mm-hmm. And just as Julian the Apostate wasn't able to do it in the Roman Empire, even if you had such a king who was going to try to bring back faith in the Northern Pantheon, it's very difficult to visualize how that would go, because any particular leader would probably just be dedicated to one god and would rule mm-hmm. in that person's name. Although he did it, you know, Thor, of course, had a popular following in terms of what most people believed in. It was that, because that was the protector god, the god of the fields, the god that you could relate to the most, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. So what has been the reaction to this film generally? I've heard some people, sort of normie types, saying, oh, it was sort of boring. It went on too long. I didn't understand what was going on, which I don't have any patience for. It is kind of an art film. It's a little longer than 2 hours. It sometimes takes an art film's pacing, but I like that. I like certain lulls in action. It gives you sort of an ability to process what's going on. I thought it was very well paced, honestly. I thought it was very poetic and aesthetically quite beautiful. I thought the script was very literate. I thought the acting was quite remarkable. I just thought overall it was an extremely good film. One of the best films I've seen this year.
There is definitely a point early on where you sort of realize you're watching a play as opposed to an action film, mm-hmm. which I think many people might have been expecting at the beginning. It has not done terribly well at the box office. It's done well critically, although, you know, there are the smattering of hostile reviews that are, it's almost like lazy. I don't even know if the critics actually believe this. It's just, are the wrong people liking this movie? And therefore, can we complain about it? I mean, it's just kind of clickbait. Because, yeah. As I said, I mean, if you're going into this movie looking for a political or racial or even theological message, you're not really going to find it. Aside from the idea that here's a character who clearly believes that he has a fate and he can't escape that fate and he has a duty to do what it says and he is rewarded for doing it. I mean, unless you're going to take that and say, well, this is the great theological message. Well, okay, but that's practically every classical drama. So, right. I mean, is it that much more threatening or subversive because they're using Odin as opposed to the muses or whatever else? Mm-hmm. And I think that insofar as there's a political or racial message, it's just that even the things that we claim are universal, even a lot of people who think they're defending Western civilization will say, they'll say Western civilization is unique and should be preserved because we have lessons for the whole world, which I think is a mistake. I mean, a civilization does not need to be justified to outsiders. Yeah. And if you're already at that point, your civilization's dead anyway. Mm-hmm. But here, it's sort of a way of learning that even the highest expressions of Western culture have deep roots, have roots mm-hmm. that go into places that maybe we might be uncomfortable talking about. And they have roots and practices that we may be uncomfortable talking about, because the people who conquered Europe after the fall of the empire were not, you know, men with horn helmets who for some reason are talking in British accents and poring over maps and trying to figure out what would be the best place to start a new town. And when people say, oh, the Vikings were also traders and they explored and things like that, this is all very true. But at the end of the day, you did have blood mad groups of warrior cults who had a religion based on sacred violence, which in some ways maybe is not that different than what the Roman legions had hundreds of years before, except they were a lot more individualistic in their fighting methods, the Vikings were.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this, the idea that the Vikings or this last gasp of, last of the old gasp anyway, of Germanic paganism, it was not this happy, friendly, we're just trading and we're open to all things type message, which is something that I feel has been oddly pushed by mainstream media outlets when it comes to do with the Vikings, that they were sort of the counter to the Catholic Church because the Vikings, unlike the Christians, were actually gender fluid and didn't believe in violence. Right. And they're tolerant and everything else. And it's like, yeah, they were not racist in the sense that if they saw a bunch of Slavs or other white people, they would just enslave them. I mean, like, they weren't racist in that sense, I guess. But in terms of the way they made their living, in terms of the values that they praised, I mean, it was not, there was no equality even of the soul in mm-hmm. Germanic paganism. And you see that too when, I mean, in this case, you have these princelings who Amleth kills. They're not really princes. They're essentially just the sons of a slaveholder in Iceland who, I guess, is a man of some means, but he's not a king. But yet, nobody looks at askew when they have a Viking funeral and they do the traditional thing where they take the slave and they kill her and throw her in the burning boat, which, you know, similar to what the practices that were being done in India that the British Empire would eventually stop. I mean, all these things kind of go back to ancient roots that have a lot of cultural signifiers that I don't think even the people who want to defend Western civilization want to talk about, because mm-hmm. we realize that the Christian era of the West was not very long, all things considered, in terms of what created us, in terms of how long we've been a civilization, how long we've been a people, and also that the kind of Christianity that took over Europe, which borrowed a lot from these warrior aristocracies. I mean, even the kings that converted to Christianity, it's not like they stopped claiming that they were descended from gods. I mean, if later on down the line, they might say, oh, this was an ancestor, or this was a saint or something, but they still maintain they came from a sacred bloodline. And that's right. What justified all their power. And the kind of Christianity that I think a lot of people who are pro-white, pro-Christianity, pro-Catholic Church, like, get behind, you have to ask yourself, well, how much of this is Christian and how much of this is that kind of Germanized Christianity that was mm-hmm. used to basically teach a warrior people that they can bend their knees to this and still have self-respect? I mean, right. Obviously, the classic text here is the Germanization of Early Medieval Christianity by James Russell,
right?
Which is probably the best academic treatment of, like, the whole process.
So Sunshine Kid has written in with $10. Thank you. He writes, from our particular historical phase of over-civilization decadence, should we attempt to return to an honor-based justice system? What would that even look like in a modern industrial liberal democracy? Also relevant is your essay, Animal Justice, and your review of Pulp Fiction, Greg. This is an important question. Can you return to an honor-based system in conditions of modernity?
I think it's just a question of whether you're in a culture that will permit you to get away with it. I would say that we probably have an honor-based justice system in the worst neighborhoods in this country. I mean, if you go to a
particularly high crime black neighborhood. And there's a culture of stop snitching. And there's a culture of people who are engaged in certain criminal lifestyle, just kind of fighting it out on the streets. And this is how you determine who gets to be the big man or not. I mean, that is an honor-based justice system. And is that something we want to duplicate? Probably not, but...
No. For me, the issue about honor, it's not so much saving face and avenging yourself and these sorts of things, showing strength. It's this primal choice that you have at all times, including in modern industrial liberal democracies, of what kind of man you're going to be, whether ultimately... what you follow is your desires, including your desire for comfortable living, long life, et cetera, or are you willing to take certain risks because it's right or because it's true? And that's really relevant to my Pulp Fiction piece. I think that the primal choice that you see in Pulp Fiction is between being motivated by honor and being motivated by desire. And the characters who choose honor have a different faith than the ones who choose desire as their ruling principle. And it's a Platonic understanding of human psychology that there are different parts of the soul, but one part can rule the others. And an honor-based human being is a person who's willing to put his life on the line, put his comfort on the line, put his money on the line, even put his reputation on the line if something is right, if something is good, if something is true. That's where I think we can recoup a certain amount of that honor culture. And it's not understood in terms of preserving necessarily reputations and things like that, or avenging slights. I think that's a superficial level of this. But reputation can be a prison too, especially reputations in societies where the value system is extremely corrupt. There's this phrase I hear all the time. It just makes me cringe. He's a great guy. He's a great guy. Being a great guy is not necessarily the same thing as being an honorable or decent or admirable man. It's just being someone you can pal around with, right? But that's the main sort of coin of reputation in modern society. Is he a great guy or not? Is he somebody we can pal around with and not be serious with, be sloppy with? He's not going to make us feel bad about ourselves, etc. That's not a reputation that you should, waspishly, reach for your sword to defend. I mean, in a way, a reputation is only worth defending if it's based on, if it's in the eyes of the right kind of peers and if it's based on the right kind of criteria.
I think as far as the specific question of whether we could set up a honor-based justice system, on a small scale, you certainly could if you had everybody involved agreeing to it. I mean, that's if you had some sort of a tribal framework in which people agreed to be bound by the judgments of whoever you decide is going to be the ones determining these things. And there obviously honor would be very important, that kinds of things in terms of doing what you said you were going to do. But in terms of whether we could have something like that on a larger scale in the United States, I mean, unfortunately, the system we have now selects more for the ability to not communicate and not be forthright in what you want. And certainly, right, as any lawyer will tell you, the first thing that happens in any kind of criminal trial is if you're talking to the police or something like that, the best thing to do is say nothing.
Yeah.
Because it could be used against you. Now, of course, that isn't what we should want. I mean, if we had a normal society, you would think that if you didn't do anything wrong and you explain to police officers, hey, I didn't do anything wrong, this is what happened. And they say, oh, okay. And then they let you go and that's the end of it. But when you're in a society like ours, the law becomes, everyone knows it's a game at some level. Everyone knows that there's no such thing as equality under the law. It's a question of whether you get the right judge. It's a question of whether you have the money to pay the right lawyer. And so in that sense, the legal system is discrediting itself. And I think a lot of it is just because WASPs are the only people in the world who will stop at a red light at 3 a.m. when there's nobody around. They're and they assume this respect for the law as such, you know, a law that even the king is bound by, that this applies equally to all other groups. And that just isn't true. And so if we do see some alternative sort of justice system developed, it probably won't be in forms that we particularly like. Leftists, of course, now are moving toward this idea of a, I'm trying to remember what they call it, but it's a restorative justice, where essentially it's not you go to jail, but you work for the community you harmed, you go to counseling, you do all this sorts of other stuff. Now, I think that's mostly targeted at the people who they just don't want the criminal justice system to send to jail anymore. They want to give them something a bit easier. But it'd be interesting to see how it works with criminals that the system really does want to see go down. Like if you took a, I don't even know who, but if you took somebody who put right-wing flyers up somewhere, does he go to jail? Does he have to just get counseling on how diversity is good, actually? I mean, how does this all work out?
What about James Fields? Should he be picking up trash?
It'll be interesting to see how the whole situation with the Chris, what was it, Wakosha, where they had the man who ran over six people at the Christmas parade. Was that Wakosha, Wisconsin?
Oh,
the fact that we're even having to think about it a little bit tells you something.
Yeah, I like to call it Waukesha, Wisconsin.
Waukesha. Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in terms of what he's sentenced to if he's convicted. It seems pretty hard to believe he won't be convicted of something. But
yeah, compare his sentence to James Fields. That'll be a very, very revealing moment.
I mean, this is,
I can see an article at Amron. I can visualize that article right now.
It's almost too tiresome to write, though. It's just because we all know it at this point. It's, you know, again, conservatism, the epitaph, like imagine if the situation was reversed. At a certain point, it's like, okay, we get it. Yeah, there are double standards.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can only point to the double standards so many times where, I mean, people, if you're going to see it, you'd have seen it by now.
Yeah, well, there's always new people. This is one thing that we have to bear in mind. You go to a concert and it's Beethoven Symphony Number 5, and you think, I've heard this so many times. But there will be a person in that audience who's never heard it before. And you know, we're trying to get to those new normies who are showing up. And if we can get the perfect article flaying the latest flagrant, horrible racial double standard and injustice into the right hands, we might just, you know, switch somebody on. So I hate repeating myself, and this is what I have to tell myself over and over again. No, you must repeat yourself. You must repeat yourself. I used to say things like, oh, please, double standards, that's for Stormfront. But no, we must repeat ourselves. There are new people showing up all the time, and we might be the key. You know, we can leverage whatever verdict comes out of the Waukesha massacre to our benefit.
Well, I mean, I don't want to leverage it so much as stop seeing these things happen. I just don't think we're going to see it stop. I mean, I think that if there's one takeaway from this story that we can use without devolving into chest beating and cries of vengeance, I think that we should consider honor a useful concept, not just for us as individuals, but for us collectively. And I think one of the reasons whites find themselves in this position is because whites, as a race, as a people, don't have the reputation of being honorable in the sense of standing up for ourselves, standing up for our collective self-interest.
We don't riot.
Right. And
we don't chimp. We need to start chimping. You want honor culture? Look at chimps.
Well, I think that what we need to be pushing for are some very specific laws and very specific changes, not the least of which should be that in a case like this, if you have expressions of hatred against whites, as you have the defendant in this case, and then you have this action take place, if this doesn't count as a hate crime, then there really shouldn't be hate crimes.
Absolutely.
And if you should have penalties
for faking a hate crime that are equivalent to the penalties for committing a hate crime. Because the reason we have hate crimes, the rationalization for it is because these crimes are uniquely dangerous to the social fabric. Well, it follows that making up lies is also dangerous to the social fabric, just as dangerous. And so it's not more dangerous because you're creating tensions where there were none before. And so I think that there are specific things that we can push for and demand. They don't even need to be done from an explicitly pro-white point of view, but simply from a fairness point of view, from the point of view that can be put forward by mainstream politicians and everything else. But people have to push for it. People have to start arguing for these types of things, because otherwise we just get these situations where it's just backlash politics, where the Republican who says, well, boy, isn't the left wacky, gets elected, and then he gets in and doesn't do anything that has anything to do with this country. It's just sort of, you know, what new wars can we start overseas? Well, meanwhile, here, people are seeing their careers and their communities and everything they valued fall apart in their hands, and their own elected officials have no answers for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this has been a really good discussion. We're coming to an end. One thing that I've said for years, and I actually had Aidan Cassiel write an article on this topic with this title, that fake hate crimes are real hate crimes against white people. And they have to be treated as hate crimes against white people. And if we're not just a race that's going to be bulldozed and run over, we have to stand up for ourselves on things like this. Either get rid of hate crimes altogether or enforce them equally. And another thing is that the left loves to paint with a very broad brush of systemic responsibility for things they don't like. We have to say, okay, if Greg Johnson is somehow responsible, you know, magically, because he has bad thoughts about Black people, for the fact that Black people shoot one another at birthday parties over small slights across entire continents from him, if somehow I have those magic powers to do that, don't the people in the media who lie about race and who cover up crimes and who broadcast other crimes, don't they have some responsibility? Don't the people who magnify BLM propaganda and justify with, you know, putting out the myth that somehow it's justified to kill people if you claim that they said the dreaded N-word, stuff like that. These people share responsibility. If we have a broad criterion of responsibility, then the media are up to their armpits in blood because of racial violence they stoke in this country. And we need to demand that these people be held accountable in some way.
Well, and it's also the question of who has the megaphone. I mean, if you have to be looking for our type of message, at least somewhat now, because of the way they skewed the search results and everything else. Yet I'm very surprised at how the number of people coming to the website continues to grow, even as deplatforming continues. Speaking about Amaranth.
Same here.
That tells me that there, in some ways, there's a larger movement, but it's more cowed, perhaps, than it was a couple of years ago, for good reason. But the kind of fish and water thing that we always have to be kind of reminding ourselves of is the fact that every day in mainstream news articles, you have this kind of racial incitement. And if they're going to do this game where they say, oh, a talk show that this one guy may have heard is the reason he did this crime or that crime, I mean, if that's the standard, then basically every Black on white crime in the country is the fault of every single journalist, every single professor, every single NGO head, the president, the vice president, most of the members of Congress, because what do they hear 24/7? The only reason you're in the situation you're in is because of white racism. Well, guess what? Even if that just lingers as a kind of vague background hostility against whites, that's still there. And that's still going to be a contributing factor. And, you know, if some white guy went out there and just punched a Black guy in the back of the head for no reason, and then they raided his house and found, I don't know, a right-wing book, that might be enough for him to be convicted of a hate crime, even if he didn't have any racial altercations and was just drunk or having a bad day or wanted to hit somebody or something like that. But when you have other cases where you have people saying, you know, I hate whites. I don't like white people, like the New York subway shooter. In that case, if you look at who he was targeting, I wrote about that case. I think it's very hard to make the argument that he was targeting whites with the shooting. I don't think that's actually true, but it's very clear that he didn't like whites and he expressed a group bias against white people and against minorities for being too pro-white.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that would be enough for a white person to be charged with a hate crime if they did anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's your motive, it's your intent. And even if it doesn't play out exactly that way in the crime, we all kind of understand that this all-purpose accusation of hate is enough.
Yeah.
Well, if it's not in this case, we really have to start have people start pushing for, shall I say, equity in these sorts of prosecutions.
Right. Well, because, you know, here's another form of equity I'd like to push for. If blacks and leftists in general wish to claim that white people today are collectively responsible for the crimes committed by whites hundreds of years ago, slave owners, etc., I think it's only equitable that blacks today be held collectively responsible for crimes committed by members of their race. Now, if you just enunciate that, oh, the shock, the horror, right? The horror that people would have. For first of all, there's so many crimes, you know, there's so much punishment that would need to be meted out. But the principle is the same. And yet people blandly, sheepish, sheep-like, you know, cow-like, accept this idea, oh yes, whites collectively responsible, but we will not hold blacks collectively responsible for crimes committed by blacks this very day.
Right.
And maybe right.
If there's one last, and to say one last thing, just relating it to the film and everything else, what this film shows us is that, you know, whenever you do your genetics tests and try to find out about your family background, everybody wants to think they're descended from a king. Everybody wants to think they're descended from some great hero. Given the fact that kings had more kids, yeah, maybe you did have a royal hero in your line somewhere. But the fact is, you were probably the product of peasants and serfs and slaves
soldiers. We were descended from savages, slaves, slave owners,
and
rapists, rape victims,
right,
et cetera.
Sometimes the same two did the same thing because it was an awful world that they were plunged into after the fall of the empire. And I think that it's important when they make the case that white people collectively, because the way they would respond to what you had just said is they would say, well, white people collectively benefit from these systemic racist institutions that continue to rule them today. I would argue that, of course, the institutions are explicitly anti-white and can, you know, come at you with figures and cases to prove otherwise, but forget that for a second.
Yeah.
The biggest thing is that whites do not collectively benefit from these structures that have grown up. Most whites were not, they didn't come out as history's winners. If you were living in Poland, if you were living in Eastern Europe, that whole last century, something horrible was coming for your family from one direction or the other. The same is true if you were living in England in certain centuries, and for Anglo-Saxons out there, you're descended from those people.
Yeah.
And this idea that whites are forever history's victors, I think, is dangerous both to leftists and also, frankly, to pro-white advocates who think that we've just always been conquerors.
And we're so
that's just
awesome.
Not true.
Yeah. No, I am a 10th and an 8th and a 6th generation survivor of Indian massacres. You know, this is just real. This happened to our people. And this is why when people start waxing poetic about the virtues of the savages that our ancestors encountered on this continent, I'm kind of deaf to that, because I know that if a tomahawk had been, you know, moved or an arrow had moved a little to the left or a little to the right, I would not exist. And there were many, many contingencies where that could have happened. So, yeah, we're not sitting on a great big pile of gold crowned by laurels, history's winners. And it's a very dangerous delusion to paint ourselves that way. And it plays into the hands of our enemies.
Yeah, that's not true. I mean, if you ever want to read about battle where the good guys do not win. I mean, read about the fall of Constantinople and understand that these things have happened and will continue to happen. But you do have a choice in the way you meet it. I do believe in fate as a literal thing. And at the end of it, the only choice you really have is the way you choose to meet your fate.
Right. Yeah, it's a good, solid Stoic teaching. And I basically agree with that. So, Greg, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you for coming on. I really hope we can do this again very, very soon. Folks, if you haven't seen The Northman, it's really worth seeing. And I would like it to be a successful film. I'm told it's done quite well in Europe, but I'm being told it's not doing very well in America. So that makes me sad. And I would like more films like this to be made. I certainly don't want Robert Eggers, the director, to have a big loss because of this very noble project that he's done.
Well, it's a shame because, I mean, again, and I'm not Eggers, I should have mentioned this earlier. I mean, he supposedly was trying to reclaim Nordic mythology from white supremacists or something, and that's why he made the movie. Whether that's what he believes or what he feels he has to say doesn't particularly matter.
Yeah.
The point is, it's not a pro-white movie in any political sense, except for showing the fact that whites have a complicated history of our own.
Yeah.
And we aren't allowed to have that. And I think that alone is enough for it to be considered racist. And that's why you don't have the kind of mainstream media lining up behind it the same way you do a lot of other films that arguably are even more artsy and refined and not aiming for a mass audience. And I think one of the big things that people need to keep in mind is what Jonathan Bowden said, reading about your own past is a revolutionary act.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. This will be up on the website in the coming week, and we will definitely have you back again in the future. Thank you.